We begin with a comment period on the petitions for rulemaking on conservation of Western Gray Squirrel. Carl Whitaker.
Chair, members of the board. I'm Carl Whitaker, I'm a senior scientist and policy analyst at the Washington Forest Law Center. I'm pleased with the variety of positive actions outlined in the 2013 annual report on the voluntary protection approach for Western Gray Squirrel. The improved FPA screening process, increased survey efforts, and status review are especially important to ensure Western Gray Squirrels receive adequate protection from the impacts of forest practices. Despite these efforts, I remain concerned about the vulnerability of the very small population to statewide extirpation for the following reasons. First, the current petition for rulemaking cites recurring problems in implementing the voluntary management guidelines since 1996. Second, the annual report documented minimal or inadequate Western Gray Squirrel protection in 26% of the recent management plans, as just recently discussed. And third, WDFW has documented frequent noncompliance with the management guidelines specified in FPAs. Given ongoing habitat loss due to natural disturbance, the Western Gray Squirrel cannot afford further habitat loss due to timber harvest that is inconsistent with current management guidelines. As the status review of the Western Gray Squirrel proceeds, I expect WDFW will determine that the voluntary management approach without an enforceable standard is insufficient to stabilize Washington's Western Gray Squirrel population. In contrast to the petition for rulemaking before you today, I believe it's most appropriate for the 2010 management guidelines to be codified as critical habitat state to prevent further take of the Western Gray Squirrel due to timber harvest. Thank you.
Thanks. Rob Cavanaugh.
My name is Rob Cavanaugh. I used to be the environmental officer at Fort Lewis, so I know a little bit about Western Gray Squirrel issues over there. That provided me with this handout. And I wanted to give you kind of an update. You'll be getting a monthly newsletter from Friends of the Western Gray Squirrel in the mail. The habitat continues to decline. Okanagan and Chelan County, we lost really serious areas. The Black Canyon area is gone, the Gold Canyon, and the Squaw Canyon area are decimated. And so that was the heart of our Western Gray Squirrel population in Okanagan. That's pretty much gone. The Klickitat Skamania area is experiencing uncontrolled pine beetle problems all the way from White Salmon north to Trout Lake. And I work closely with SDS Timber Company and have for years, and they think this is going to be a big problem for squirrels. And they're very cooperative in helping us protect the squirrels. DNR records and wildlife records show continuing issues with non-compliance with permitted sport practice permit. The voluntary Western Gray Squirrel plans are without enforcement, and you can't put conditions on the forest practices permits. You can put them conditions on other issues, but you can't do it on Western Gray Squirrels for reasons I don't understand. The new Bio 3 position has not been filled. It was supposed to be filled in 1 July. It was supposed to be filled in 1 August. It was supposed to be filled in 1 September. They don't have it. And if they don't do it quickly, the money goes away. And I'm very concerned about that. We're publishing a monthly newsletter. You'll be getting that. And it talks about the continuing and ever-increasing loss of habitat due to fires, pine beetle disease, squirrel disease, unmanaged logging, and urbanization is taking its toll. RCW 7609 provides you with a legislative mandate to protect wildlife. That's RCW 76.09.010. under WAC 222-16-080, bowling at 3, you have the authority to protect threatened species habitat using a landscape basis of management approach. I provided you with some attachments defining what landscape scale management is, how it's used, where it's used, and how it can be used by the DNR. It is not being used to protect Western Grace Grove at this time, and it is a key to success, landscape management. One thing I'd like to mention to you, the Wildlife Department talked about going around looking up in the trees for nests. I don't know if they haven't figured this out yet, but squirrels love to nest in trees, in the holes of trees. And so they could walk right by a tree with a squirrel nest in it, and they'd say, there are no squirrels there. So they need to get better science going here. Western gray squirrels love to nest in cavities of Oregon white oak. And we know that from our personal experiences. On the positive side, we now have 4 volunteer degree biologists willing to help you and wildlife do this Western gray squirrel work and work with the public. There are 3 of them down in Klickitat County. 2 of them are retired Forest Service biologists. 1 is an active biologist now, and then we have 1 up in Okanagan County who provided me with the information on the impact of fires on the Western gray squirrel population. So I would encourage you to draft rules, not new rules, but using your existing authority to further protect Western gray squirrels. You don't have to write a new rule. It's not required. Just follow the existing legislative mandate, and you'll be right in there, and you can take care of Western gray squirrels quite well. So that's what I wanted to tell you. And you have my handout, and I hope you'll consider protecting Western gray squirrels. Any questions?
Thanks. Tim McBride.
Good morning, Honorable Chairman, members of the board, especially you, Court. I'm Tim McBride. I'm a wildlife biologist with Hancock Forest Management. In the state of Washington, we manage over 750,000 acres of industrial timberland. 70,000 of those acres are in Klickitat County that actually lie between White Salmon, the city of White Salmon, and Trout Lake, and we have no untested mountain pine beetle devastation going on. I think many of you probably understand that industrial timberlands, we're not going to stand for pine beetle devastation, so it doesn't impact any of our gray squirrel habitat down there. I would hope that you can indulge me a few minutes more than the customary 3. I have a little bit of history with this critter. We've been managing our 70,000 acres since 2005. And I met Bill Weiler at that time. He was a habitat biologist down there. And I got to say, the way that the petition is written and some of the ideas and the concerns that they're raising are quite old, as we've moved far past a lot of those issues that they talk about in there. Namely, the first one being that 60,000 acres of the old Boise Cascade ground was sold and is not being used as gray squirrel habitat. That's just totally false. Western Pacific Timber, an industrial timberland company, actually owns that ground, and they are actually a contributor, direct funding, as well as science to my Hancock Forest Management study that's actually manifested into a PhD dissertation program for myself at this time. So. Their claim that that ground is not being used for Western gray squirrel conservation is not right. So let me bring you guys back a little bit. In 2007, many of us industry representatives and the county officials met with WDFNW down in Klickitat County. Harriet Allen and Derek Stinson were on that. And I actually have the meeting. The meeting agenda was developed by Frank Backus. If any of you know Frank Backus, you can tell he's kind of a gruff and harsh guy. But number 4 on that agenda was discussion of possible ways an agreement can be developed and how would that work with WDFNW to implement the voluntary guidelines across a lot of the industrial timberland owners. And those people that showed up to that meeting represented the Krepps family ranch. Joan Fry, who was at that time county commissioner, is also a large landowner. Dave McClure from the county was there. Myself, Neil Kaiser, who's a big rancher and landowner, as well as Western Pacific, SDS, Longview Fiber, and those things. So there's a whole host of people that were interested in working with the state to implement the voluntary guidelines and see how we could understand how gray squirrels interact with the managed forest. And this started in 2007. And what that manifested into was by 2011, I got myself accepted at the Michigan State University for my PhD on Western gray squirrels. And this was built on a year's worth of pilot study data looking at how the gray squirrel interacts with our timber harvest program on our ground, what vegetation characteristics look like, and how the animals respond after harvest. So we've gone a pretty far and long way since then. And I would say that it hasn't been without the help of WDFNW. At the time when we were just scratching the surface of investigating some changes to some of the guidelines, you know, it's a range of things, right? 20 to 60% canopy cover, these kinds of things. We had a young man named Ted Labby, who was a WDFNW employee out of the region down there, who came out and wrote management plans for us. And since then, we've worked hand in hand with Gary Bell, Sam Kolb at sometimes. And so there's a whole number of WDFNW representatives who actually come out on the ground and help us. It's not like there's been big voids. So that's kind of two things that in the petition just clearly are not well justified. And the third thing, if you look at one of the augmentation plans that was written by Matt Vanderhagen, Dr. Vanderhagen, it identifies that they have very little knowledge about how eastern gray squirrels interact with western gray squirrels. And that was written in 2007. And so 7 years ago, we just didn't understand. And so for the petition to claim that we have to do something because an eastern gray squirrel has been spotted in Klickitat County is just kind of crazy, right? Why can we base it just on that when nobody really knows how they interact? So I would caution you to not accept this petition based on those three items that are unjustified in their petition. And finally, I would just say that if you look at the report that Dr. Becker and Terry Jackson have given you today, and they identify the whole area of research efforts that the department is undergoing. Without Dr. Vanderhagen being here to back me up, I might take a little liberty and speak for him. And he does not identify any research efforts that the department is going to do in Klickitat County, because Hancock Forest Management and the whole host of other landowners and county representatives that are down there are actually doing that research right now. And I think that gives Dr. Vanderhagen a little bit of latitude to be able to focus his very small amount of resources to the other two places in the state where western gray squirrels are known to be. So we've got a lot of things going for the western gray squirrel. And if you accept this petition to go back to something that was written in 1996, you're going to kind of forget everything that we've done to get us to a very collaborative state of understanding of gray squirrel conservation over the last 15 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We now have action on the two petitions for rulemaking. Board packets. Mark, please come join us, and I'd like Penny to come and join us again afterward, specifically around the question of the fire and the potential impacts from the property complex fire. And Mark, just. Board's been through a number of petitions here in the last little while, but for the record, why don't you restate process that we go through on petitions.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Mark Engel, Assistant Division Manager in Forest Practices. Chair and members of the board. The board has, our board staff, has received two petitions for Western Gray Squirrel rulemaking. The first of which is actually contained in your agenda for tomorrow, because that was a petition that was two-part for both Unstable Slopes as well as Western Gray Squirrel. It expresses concern over habitat loss to wildfires and pine beetles. And then it first asks for wildlife for their authority under their statute to write rules, and then for the board to amend the Forest Practices Rule, which is 222-1608-0, to protect Western Gray Squirrel. The second petition was dated July 25th. It requests the board to amend the Critical Habitat State Rule, again, 222-1608-0, to add, quote, the former Western Gray Squirrel Management Guidelines contained in Table 1 in that petition, into rule to ensure conservation of one of the largest squirrel populations in North America. Without going into any more detail contained within the petitions, I just need to inform the board that the board must no later than 60 days after receipt of the complete petition, or based on receipt of the first petition in this case, by September 21st, so a little more than 2 weeks, either initiate rulemaking proceedings in accordance with Chapter 3405 in the statute, or deny the petition in writing stating the reasons for the denial, specifically addressing the concerns stated in the petition. Where appropriate, the board will indicate alternative means by which the board will address the concerns raised in the petition. So.
Mark, questions of Mark?
I guess the only information really that I have to present as far as the Western Gray Squirrels related to the general map that I passed out earlier, there is an ongoing assessment of the impact of the Carlson Complex fires to the Western Gray Squirrel habitat in North Cascades. At very first glance, using imagery, it looks like approximately 30% of what we knew as known habitat at the time may have been affected in some way, but the level of how it's been affected and how that affects the species is still an unknown. We do have the benefit of having some surveys that were done in some of those areas before the burn happened in these last previous years, and so the same citizen science group and our scientists are going to be going back to those areas and looking at the effect on the species and what has been left as far as habitat goes. So that's upcoming this next year.
Thanks. Questions from staff? Okay. Should stick around in case something comes up in the discussion. Further discussion on the action item.
I'm sitting here as a representative of the small landowners, and I really appreciate the work that's being done by the large landowners in conjunction with the Western Gray Squirrel. And I think it's an attribute for the small landowners to have a partner that's looking out after the Western Gray Squirrel on a voluntary basis. And I believe that the small landowners would say we appreciate that.
Go, Board Member Herrera.
With respect to the recent forest fires, you said there would be an assessment done, a more thorough assessment of the impact to the habitat and the potentially to the gray squirrel. Do you know how long it's going to take to do that assessment?
Well, so I have to say it's ongoing for several different species that we're working on. It also contains important wielder habitat and others. So we're, as of now, looking at getting some better imagery of the fire area and then getting people on the ground. The assessment, I think the citizen scientists are working on a bit this fall, and then they'll have to start again in the spring because that's the best time to do their detection of the species.
Diversity.
So the presentation that you gave a little bit earlier, and I'm just checking my facts on this. So the status review is going to include a look at population demographics. Is that not correct?
Yeah, as much as whatever's available.
Right, right. And then and also habitat interactions. So, you know, those two things, in my mind, tend to be really important to understand prior to making decisions on rulemaking, in addition to taking into consideration the effectiveness of all of the voluntary plans. So I know that we've received a lot of petitions on Western Grace Forum over the last bit of time, and I say this every time, and I'll say it again, that I appreciate citizen engagement and concern on this issue. I think that certainly all of the efforts of the two state agencies and the landowners to get their handle on what's going on, to do research, to do voluntary management on the ground, all contribute to improving our picture of what's happening. I don't discount or dismiss the fact that there can or should be concerns about the population, but I, as a board member, feel like everybody is putting in an enormous amount of effort to try to figure it out, and that we will have a much better sense of whether or not some additional action is required and what that action looks like, as part of the status review and as we learn more about how things are unfolding on the ground. And Mr. McBride's research, or soon to be Dr. McBride's research, in addition to the research that your staff is doing. So I guess I would just continue to say that people are putting a really great effort in on the ground, and that it's not right yet. And actually, one more thing, really quickly, I would just make a request of new board member Gunther that I know that it's a little bit harder for small forest landowners to get access to the resources to do this kind of thing, but anything that you can do to help facilitate communication and outreach to that part of the community on this topic, I think would be helpful.
I wonder if it's a little bit out of the lane of the board as far as small forest landowner, typical small forest landowner advisory committee work, but to have representatives of the department on the landowner assistance side, small forest landowner side, work with Department of Fish and Wildlife to do some active education around the issue, particularly with the small forest landowners in Clickitat County. I'm not sure how many board members are familiar with the pattern of land ownership in Clickitat County. Sort of roughing it out, it's probably a little over half industrial. State trust lines and kind of a large landowner group, and then the other, a little bit less than half, is small forest landowners, relatively small parcels. The department having worked a considerable amount in that area, focusing on forest health issues, we've discovered the technical difficulty of being able to communicate effectively with landowners who have a second home or a small parcel somewhere, but perhaps live in Portland or live in Vancouver or Germany or something. I mean, the variety of places that that folks actually reside in juxtaposition to where the property is actually located is pretty disparate in that area in particular. So, I think perhaps as a follow-up action item, we might ask and charge the Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee with working together amongst the two agencies to scope out an education effort of some kind.
We can do that.
Okay. Further discussion?
If I could, that's basically why I said what I said. It's what you just indicated is that we're very fortunate to have people that are willing to take this forth, because we couldn't be organized enough to do it.
Board member White.
Thank you. The report that we had on voluntary efforts was very interesting. Very good to see that, and of course it reflects directly on these petitions. I agree with Paula that it's good to have this issue in front of us. It sometimes is a little bit awkward in terms of the way the petitions come forward and how you know, whether they're specific or general as to what we can do with them. But I think having this subject in front of us is good, and it's making us request and keep our focus on this. And I think we're on the right track right now. And with the work that's ahead of us, I think it's premature to go to a rule. But I am very concerned about the five management plans in the report that are listed as being inadequate. You know, how is that happening? What can make them better? If we can do this in the voluntary system, that is great. Some of this stuff really isn't amenable, I don't think, to rules very well. So we're going to find out here very shortly whether this volunteer approach will work. I think reaching out to small forest landowners is particularly a good way of going and useful. And that would be regardless of whether we did a rule or not. I mean, it's one thing to have a rule, it's another thing to have compliance and outcome on the landscape. And I think that's what we're focused on here. We're focused on the result. And how we get there is we'll be evaluating as we go. So I do think we're on track, and it's great to see the cooperative approaches that we've got going. As I say, I'm concerned about the five that are listed in the report as being inadequate, and I hope that we can improve on that number. And a couple of those were industrial, but a few of them were small. So I think we're doing good. Thanks.
Board Member Stanley?
Not to be repetitive, but I, after listening to the report on the butterfly, we know that voluntary plans can be effective, and I think it boils down to outreach. I would like to see a bit more research on post-harvest to see if they were, the five plans were inadequate or not. We don't know. But it's based on older research, and I'm anxious to see Tim's dissertation come out when he's finished. But I do believe the voluntary approach is the right path at this time.
Additional discussion? Okay, so I think by order, we need to deal with the petitions as separate actions. So the first of them is the July 25th petition from Mr. Weiler. I guess before we go there, Board Member Davis, Board Member Balish, you're on the phone and it's hard to break in. I want to provide you an opportunity to say what's on your mind.
Thanks. This is Board Member Balish. I don't have anything to add, but thanks for the opportunity.
So this is Board Member Davis, and I appreciate all of the information and feel like I'm still learning, but appreciate the opportunity to jump in and don't have anything else to add either. Thank you.
So, continuing, we need an action on the July 25th Weiler petition. Is there a motion?
I'll make a motion. I move to deny petition.
Motion's been made. Is there a second?
Second.
Motion made by Board Member Stanley, second by Board Member Gunther. Further discussion on the motion while Patricia's spooling up the screen?
When we deny a petition, and we've done this enough now, I should know, do we also explain the activities that we're doing to address the underlying issue?
Yeah, the discussion that's had at the board, the statements made by board members, the staff reports and so forth are sort of in summary form in terms of the response to the petitioner. It's a bit different for this board to deal with a petition for rulemaking than it is for an agency, because it's sort of exclusive authority to speak on behalf of board members who might think different factors are more important than others. It's something that I guard awfully carefully for the part of what gets represented as a board's petition or board's position. So generally, we confine the response to what's covered in staff information, Q&A, and board member statements. Further discussion on the motion? Board Member Sweeney.
I'm just throwing this out there for all of us to think about, you know, given that we've had several petitions on this species in the past, but I do want to make sure that we convey our continued support and the necessity for the work that we've directed both agencies to do in the past. So this isn't just, you know, here, this petition, move on. You know, it's that if we're denying the petition because all of this other work is being done and we're continuing to monitor the situation. And so perhaps having some sort of statement on this denial just to make sure that's clear.
Within the motion?
Within the motion, yes.
Okay.
Do you think that's necessary? Do you think we've got that covered in past motions?
Two ways we can do that. If you'd like to have offer an amendment to add some text to the motion, we can do it that way. We can also have sort of direct staff to make sure that the record reflects that separate. As far as
that's kind of what I was talking about.
How the issue was so our folks, you've all so there isn't a motion on the floor yet, so we'll continue to discuss. But you've all seen the manner in which the board communicates with petitioners around the decisions that the board makes on petitions. Is that going to capture in your experience the issue that you just raised, or do you want to make an additional attempt to make an additional text to the motion? How do folks feel about that? Ambivalence?
I think we've made every effort to make sure that the petitioners know that it's high on our priority list to continue to monitor and to develop a process that's satisfactory. So I'm happy with the simple motion.
Okay, so let me just tie this off. Patricia, you captured the basic sentiment that was just expressed as far as what ends up in the minutes. So without objection, we can make sure that the correspondence with the petitioner reflects that statement sent on the SBI. Further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I call questions. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Abstentions? Motion carries. On the second petition, which as Mark notes, is actually on tomorrow's agenda. The purpose of it having been on tomorrow's agenda is that the petition raises two distinct issues. My hope would be, just for the purpose of board simplicity and tidiness of order at the board, that we deal with the entirety of the petition tomorrow, having heard and discussed it today, and not have two separate votes on the same petition. It's a bit of a procedural oddity, so I think it would be best for us to take the whole issue up in its entirety tomorrow. I haven't heard it today. Objections to that? Okay. Thank you both very much. Next item of business is the Clean Water Act Assurance's annual report. It's Mark Hickson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. My name is Mark Hicks. I work with the Department of Ecology. I also serve currently as CEMER co-chair, but I'm here today representing Ecology and providing you an update on our progress in meeting the corrective milestones in the Clean Water Act assurances. It was reminded to me that it's been a long time of providing regular updates to the board and that the faces have changed here, and perhaps it might be worthwhile to reflect back on what these assurances are and what the corrective milestones are all about. So I want to just take a moment to do that. So here in Washington, by law, forest practices need to comply with the water quality standards. When the forest and fish rules were negotiated, they were using the current science at the time, and the best intentions were laid out that the the rules that would result would meet water quality standards. But it was also clear there's a lot of uncertainty around many of the issues, and that it was going to be necessary to actually validate whether those rules are working through an adaptive management program. The concept of being able to rely on a robust adaptive management program to ensure that the rules are in fact working to protect water quality is at the heart of both the federal and the state assurances. As part of the 1999 Forest and Fish Report, Ecology, with support from EPA, established what became known as the Clean Water Act assurances. And what are we assuring? Well, so long as we have a vibrant adaptive management program, Ecology will continue to rely on the Forest Practices Program and the associated adaptive management program to meet water quality standards in the forest lands in the state, the private forest lands under the Forest Practices HCP. Now, the Forest Practices HCP also assumes water quality standards will be met or the rules would be changed via an adaptive management program. So this whole adaptive management program is a very important and vital part of our program here in the state of Washington. In 2009, Ecology found that the water quality-based programs were not moving ahead as effectively or as quickly as we had originally thought they would when the assurances were first laid out in 99. As a result, we put together what we are calling the Clean Water Act Corrective Milestones, and that's the point of today's briefing. And we provide this briefing about every 6 months now, just on how things are going. Sometimes it seems a little slow because it takes a while to get these tasks done. The intent of these corrective milestones is to provide both greater prioritization of water quality projects, as well as the strength and associated programs and processes that are used for making decisions and moving the research forward. And the point is that so that Ecology can clearly maintain its reliance on forest practices programs and the adaptive management program to bring about compliance with the water quality standards on the HCP lands. Okay, that's a little of a brief history. So where are we right now? Similar to past briefings, we've provided you with a briefing document that has two tables in it. The first table shows the non-CMER project milestones, and those are the ones that are generally under the purview of the TFW Policy Committee or DNR Forest Practices Operations Division to accomplish. The second table shows the CMER research study milestones. Then, keeping with what is becoming a tradition, I left in red font what had changed since the last briefing. So hopefully that's still working for folks to help focus what has changed since the last time I provided you with a briefing. So in this past 6 month period, no Clean Water Act milestones were completed. However, there are a great many projects and processes still in play moving forward to try to accomplish some of those milestones. So it's not that as if there isn't any work moving forward, but we're just not getting any out the final end of the process. So there's a number of challenges. I've pointed them out before, and most all of those still remain. We still have a limited number of researchers that have the time to actually help build research projects. There are plenty of participants, but very few that have the time and qualifications and experience to actually put into developing the study designs and following through with implementing the research on the ground. Some of this might be influenced by the fact that we still lack a stable and adequate funding source to fully fund the adaptive management program long term. That's creating some uncertainty and instability in some ways in the program. And I think it may have influenced the challenge we have in finding talented resources. So talented people to come in and help do that the heavy lifting of the program, the science program. Things have been a little shaky in that the priorities and policy have changed quite a bit over time, moving from type N to type F to mass wasting, to then putting heavy time into trying to revise the CMER master schedule. So Ecology's been a player in all these efforts, and generally speaking, we support what's been going on, but it's important to point out that just like CMER scientists' time is limited, so is the policy committee's time is limited. And every time a new priority comes in or a new project comes in, it does affect the ability to finish off the Clean Water Act milestones that have been laid out there as well. And I don't want to say that changes in priority are at their heart in conflict with the Clean Water Act milestones, because a big part of what the milestones are about is trying to create an adaptive management program that can adapt, that can respond to new information and insights and changes in an effective way. A college just needs to make sure that, in fact, the Clean Water Act priorities aren't left in the wake of all this new information and priorities. Okay. Any questions?
Questions from Mark? All right. That'll be a first.
Okay.
You sure?
Going?
So
as it's down.
Well, I'm just going to take a minute with the sort of the interrelation between the Clean Water Milestones and the capacity to get the science work done on the senior side. The people capacity, the earnest research development capacity is an issue I think that is well acknowledged by all membership to varying degrees, but that perhaps as a product is somewhat, as we've seen with the lean pilots, the initiation of additional technical writing implementation groups starts to draw in some science horsepower. Do you have a sense of whether that is limited, or whether there begins to be a bit more of an economy of scale in that type of dynamic in terms of bringing in new people that are interested in the specific subject matter or the program in general? Do we have a sense of whether there's a power curve there that we can take advantage of?
Well, I think it was mentioned earlier, we're going through a learning curve on how to actually use those groups right now, and I don't think we're going to respond to board member Laurie's comment. I don't think we're really going any faster as a result. But I do think it provides an environment for outside scientists to participate that they're more familiar with. It's a small group focused kind of process. It isn't putting them at the SEMR table that's ringed with people asking questions. It's a smaller group, and they're more comfortable with that. I think if we, once we get a new AMPA, I hope that they'll actually focus a little bit more on building those outside partnerships. Now, the folks at the table that are participating, in my view, it most effectively are the ones that see value in it also for themselves. Our research is dovetailing with their research and their interests as well. And so someone has to help them see that and help the folks on our end within CMR and policy understand that that's why those rules are working, is because they're mutually beneficial and that we're not encumbering them with the full process of CMR and policy work. We're insulating those outside folks to a certain extent from our I'll call it a bureaucracy. And I'm not saying it's necessarily a bad thing, but folks on the outside are not going to necessarily be accustomed to it or as tolerant of it. So those initial writing teams and the TWIGs, as we're calling them, technical writing implementation groups, they can be very effective. And I think we have just begun the process of trying to use it.
There was a time at CMR, at least as I understand it, when that sort of collaborative attitude prevailed, when it was a draw, in fact, to have the diversity of research interests that were sitting at the table. People actually wanted to come. We have to sort of insulate them.
That's what I hear.
So is it folks' opinion that that's the subject matter? Was a period of time when the subject matter of the research was a little more insular, or is it something else that's changed? I know that we're getting a little bit far afield from clean water here, but since we had it,
I'll put on my other hat, CMR co-chair, I guess. I've heard a number of things from folks that have been here for a long time. They believe a lot of it is the people at the table. And then I think there was a lot of good energy, because they were coming out of initial negotiations, and a lot of the higher level scientists and such from the various organizations were engaged. There's a lot of money available. So I think it could be a number of things. And I think most of the participants want the system to work that way again. But it seems to be a slow process to kind of find our new footing to get it there, get back to where folks are really engaged on the science.
If our Are the annual meetings still a draw from people that are outside the circle of the inner circle of CEMER, or is that something that...
They are, but I don't think we get the participation a lot of us would like, given the effort involved. We're talking about the CEMER science conferences. Right. And then we've had a lot of things that we've been developing. A lot of research has been in the developmental stage for a long time that is now going to be coming out. We're planning one for February, a CEMER Science Conference in February. The results from the hard rock, the type-in hard rock study, for example, will be a central focus of that. That should be, hopefully that'll start raising interest back into the overall science program and let people see what it is that we're doing. But doing state-of-the-art research is very, very time-consuming, and we kind of disappear for a while we're doing it.
I have kind of a CEMER question, also a little bit beyond water compliance. Are we seeing this type of research in other states, other areas, or other levels of government? How does what we're doing compare anywhere else?
I think we've probably got our shoulder to their work a little bit more than other entities in other states and such. But you see good work periodically coming out from other states as well as Canada that could help influence our understanding of these issues. But I don't think any other entity I've seen thus far has kind of come up to the standard that we're shooting at yet. I think some of the work we're doing right now, such as the hard rock study, I think sets the bar for good research. Which is why we can potentially attract outside scientists. They see that. The folks that are volunteering to be part of the road twig that's just getting going, they recognize that. These are really qualified researchers, but they've never had the opportunity to test these hypotheses at the scale that we can do it within the CEMER program. And that's a draw.
Yeah. So baby steps get the bodies, and the next step is maybe to their organizations contributing to that.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Board members, again.
So just as I was walking in the door this morning, a couple minutes late, there was a public comment about making sure we remembered in relation to the Clean Water Assurances report that there was a big chunk of work done to get the CEMER master schedule taken care of. And I'm connecting the dots with that comment. And I just was wondering if you could reflect on the relationship between being able to get agreement on the CEMER master schedule and how that relates to improvement in being able to meet some of these milestones on the CEMER side of the ledger.
That's a challenging question for me, honestly. I think the biggest benefit is the level of engagement that occurred within policy on trying to understand what the individual studies are. And again, getting at least a refresh for folks on how important it is to get the right questions established as part of that research. That became a whole part of reviewing the master schedule. Understanding the linkages between the studies, that some are essentially precursor studies to other ones. So I think it's probably just the biggest benefit is expanding that knowledge base in the current folks that occupy the chairs within policy. I'm hoping that helps them also work together and make better decisions as they decide which projects to fund, which projects to move potentially from a hold list to an active list, moving forward in the next year or two.
Questions for Mark?
I have one. For Tom Guthrie? Probably off scale here, but put me if I am. When you talk about twigs and bringing other experts in, even from your own, even from the Department of Ecology, the Clean Water Act, I just want to make sure that the Department of Ecology is involved in the in biosolids distribution on the ground. Because to me, I've experienced this. To me, I think that's something that folks should know about.
Okay. Other questions for Mark?
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay, our next item of business is the annual report from the Cultural Resources Roundtable. And are we expecting Co-Chair Thomas?
I've not heard from him this morning, so we can come up and do this, or what's your pleasure?
Well, you know, we are in a place here where I think we could substitute TFW policy 2014 accomplishments and 2015 priorities if we wanted to give ourselves the space for Co-Chair Thomas to join us. Any strong feelings
sure.
about that? I mean that we, yeah. So why don't we give that a shot? Stephen and Adrian, you come join us. And so for board members, it's your 2014-15 accomplishments tab that was originally scheduled for 1:35. Correct.
Good morning, Chair, board members, staff, and publics. I'm Stephen Burnett, the Department of Ecology and co-chair of TFW Policy. And in front of you, you should have three documents. One is a memo that Adrian and I prepared for your review in doing our annual priorities look forward, as well as a status report of what we're doing currently. And then attached to that is some of the issues that are currently on our calendar. It's by no means, this is our current priorities, if you will, to some degree. It is not a complete list, and sort of our monthly calendar of what we anticipate in upcoming policy meetings. So just to review with you what our existing priorities are. As you know, we adopted a type N strategy in 2013. We have one thing to complete yet on that. What is trying to come up with some guidance regarding the uppermost point of perennial flow during wet season. We basically had little or no time to even think about how to broach the where we are on that to actually explore solutions on this issue. And I still hold out hope that we can actually explore issues on that issue. Once we actually have time to do that. Type F, as you know, you provided us direction in February, and we put a plan together and was implementing that plan when the Oso landslide occurred. The result was everything got put on a back burner, and I don't see that changing until we've completed the mass wasting work that you have directed us to do as a result of the May board meeting. In addition, as you're well aware of, and we've already had some discussion around this morning, we worked very hard this summer to present you with an updated master project schedule for CEMER. The only work we foresee this coming year on that issue, because remember, we're going to a two-year schedule on the CEMER work plan, is once the legislature meets and decides on a budget, that we will have to review what they've given us versus what we adopted or what you adopted as a schedule for the next 2 years, and come to you with any adjustments that are necessary. New issues, we have just listed. Thanks to Mark, mostly, what we anticipate coming forward from CEMER. Some of these final reports will take some effort on our part to decide what to do and perhaps recommend to you or back to CEMER, depending on what the outcome of each of these final reports are. Some of these will not, as Mark mentioned in the previous discussion, won't necessarily result in anything or a predecessor to another piece of research. So There's two or three of these that will cause us to do some work and perhaps bring you something. The scoping documents and study designs are things that we do on an ongoing basis. Particularly with the TWIG process, we're very aware that we do not want to delay their work. So when they bring us a scoping document or a study design document, we want to jump on those things, get responses back to them so they can move on and actually complete the study design and move forward on the projects. I'll just stop there and ask if you have any questions.
So for board members, you can note that we've checked in with great regularity on the work policy and the priorities of work policy, because there are a lot of things to have to juggle, and as a board administered program, it's going to be our a focus of ours to do that in an active way. For the purpose of the two-day agenda and recognizing that there may be some additional direction that we may want to contemplate the policy that can affect the workload, there's an action item on that for tomorrow's agenda. So this is discussion and a better understanding of what policies and key priorities are for the purposes of today. I don't imagine that there's been a lot of effort, so I'll start the questions. I don't imagine there's been a lot of ability to map out, potential timelines for next steps on issues like Type F and Type N, which I know are very important to all kinds of different members of adaptive management, owing to the uncertainty around the amount of time and effort that will be required to complete the boards on stable source-related assignments.
I think that's a fair assumption. I think individual caucuses are thinking about those issues and how they might approach those. Perhaps I'm being a little overly optimistic, but maybe the time does give people a chance to sort of recalibrate around their positions and think about some alternatives. But in terms of formal policy work, we haven't been actively facilitating or managing any further discussions.
But I will remind the board, as I just said, that we do have a plan, and once we have time to redevote to Type F, is brushing those off, figuring out where we are in the field season here, figuring out, because we had a couple of field trips planned, those kinds of things, reorienting ourselves and getting moving again will take some effort.
That's a good point. I think it will be, when we re-engage on the Type F, we have a clear board direction and have a plan in place, so it shouldn't be too hard to think about.
You also have a pulse of study designs and some study results coming to policy over the next year. How are we proposing to manage that alongside all of the many other thorny things that we've assigned?
Well, I can give one example, and that we're slowly learning that we have to prioritize. And for example, with the Voltrout Overlay Temperature Project, if you recall, we have prescribed timelines in rule, I believe, to respond to CEMA work. And unless we all agree to postpone that decision, we're held to those timelines. And policy did agree to delay the decision on whether or not to take action on the Voltrout Overlay Temperature Project until this next policy meeting. And that bought us a couple of months worth of time. So I think that people are going to be looking at the study results, and I think all studies deserve a full and fair vetting, but I think most caucuses recognize that some study results, sort of show a certain amount of risk, other study results may show less, and I think the group is more willing to sort of delay discussion around those that the group perceives as having sort of less urgency.
Questions for the co-chairs? Well, I think the forces of the universe always align against being committed to a work plan and have some discipline about what the priorities are and sticking to them. Particularly when I look at the volume of science-related work that we anticipate needing to do alongside all of the other balls that we've got in there, or chainsaws, maybe that's a better metaphor to be juggling. I think we need to be conscious of that capacity and be dedicated to it. The board is going to be dedicated to it. If there are difficult to resolve issues of competing priorities that are not resolvable in policy, I expect those to be the subject of these types of reports and updates. So I appreciate the that the board falls victim to competing priorities in the same way that everybody else participates in the program does. So we're going to continue to discuss what's on first here. And be afraid to ask us if there's any lack of clarity about it. Questions? Board members, please.
Well, this is thinking a little far out, but I certainly see this pattern of unanticipated issues coming up, something as big as the landslide, and pushing everything else off, that there may come a day in the distant or not too distant future when there needs to be big picture thinking about how to allocate all of this work and not have it just be on this one body. And I'm not really proposing anything at this point in time other than to say we may need to think outside the box and, you know, divide the committee from people, something, to get more work done, because I think there's important resource protection work that isn't getting done, and it's not anybody's fault, right? It's just there's a lot to do. This is one of the most comprehensive, you know, complicated resource protection systems, I think, that are in the country, exist in the country. And it has a little bit of risk of collapsing under its own weight at some point in time. And so I would just ask all of us to think about ideas for, you know, how to do things differently and not necessarily within the confines of policy or the active management program, but, you know, something even bigger. So, and also just to say that I appreciate everybody's work, because I know this is a difficult time, but this may not, we may not be able to get to things fast enough at some point in time.
Anything else for the co-chairs? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Yogi. So now, trying to kill 10 minutes in an effort to buy ourselves some time, but I still don't see Co-Chair Thomas here. I think we ought to proceed with the report. Sir, objection to that?
Good morning, Chair Everett and members of the board. For the record again, my name is Karen Terwilliger with the Washington Forest Protection Association. I'm appearing in front of you right now as the co-chair of the Cultural Resources Roundtable. And unfortunately, my co-chair is not able to attend this morning, so I'm going to go ahead and do the report. I know that he would be available for questions if you have them, if I don't cover them appropriately. So you have two documents in your packet, and I apologize for the lateness of these documents, but we had some discussion in terms of drafting and some illness in various parts of our group, so we weren't able to get them to you in as timely a manner as they will be in the future. So you have two documents. The first is Cultural Resources Roundtable staff report to the, should be actually the, should be May, but September quarterly Forest Practices Board meeting. And this is our quarterly report. You also have an annual report. And the interesting and important thing about the quarterly report is that we always attach a items list of what we're actually doing throughout the year. And like the Clean Water Act milestones, we identify those things that have changed from our last report in red. And the first item that has changed is that we are in the process of reviewing DNR's FPA conditioning authority as it relates to cultural resources. And I'll talk a little bit about that in the annual report. But that has become our number one issue that we're dealing with. So if you will turn to the annual report, couple of things to keep in mind about our process. In past years, the Cultural Resources Roundtable, or I'm just going to call us the Roundtable, has met on a monthly basis. For the last 2 years, we've been experimenting with different types of meeting schedules. So this past year, we've met every other month as a formal group, and then we've had workshops to really focus on individual projects in the intervening months. And that has worked pretty well in terms of being able to get work done, because we can focus on a workshop item and get it completed by the end of the workshop rather than dealing with a whole slew of items. But there has been a couple of issues of controversy that have come up. So our major accomplishment this year was to rewrite the instructions that are associated with the Forest Practices application as they relate to cultural resources. And this was an endeavor that has actually taken some time, and you wouldn't expect it to, but there's a lot of nuance in terms of how the instructions are written that go along with the FPA, the application itself. And the instructions were clarified to identify the issues related to where a landowner might find cultural resources or archaeological resources. In past years, archaeological resources weren't even identified in the FPA. So we wanted to make sure that landowners had a very good understanding of where they might find these things. This is an attempt to educate landowners as they go through the process. As you may be aware, industrial landowners often have very long-standing relationships with tribes in their area, and so they have these relationships and plans that are developed. But a landowner that may not harvest on a regular basis, a smaller or medium-sized landowner, may not have the same level of understanding and education in the process. So rewriting the instructions was really an attempt to identify for them where there might be an issue. Second part of the instruction rewrite was to really describe the process that they need to go through when a landowner is dealing with a tribe on a cultural resource issue, and what the appropriate way to do that is. Forest Practices Board has adopted a regulation related to how that process works, and the instructions really focus on how a landowner might work with tribes and figure out how to make that process work as well. So that was our major accomplishment this year. The second piece of what we generally do is do a survey of folks that are dealing with cultural resources issues, cultural resources plans. And last year we surveyed landowners, both small landowners, large landowners, tribes, agency folks, and vets. And we had a pretty good response. This is actually, last year was the second year of the survey. This year we ran into two issues in terms of doing the survey. One was a technical issue, just in terms of the way our survey process was working, so it wasn't as timely as we wanted it to be. And then the second issue is this issue related to FPA conditioning authority that came up, and the members of the roundtable decided to hold off on the survey until we have more resolution of that issue related to FPA conditioning. So there are no questions about those two things. I'll go into the situation we found ourselves in. So we've been in the process of looking at the guidance documents that are associated with the Forest Practices application itself, as well as information for landowners in terms of identifying and dealing with cultural resources on the ground. And so there's been probably a 2 to 3 year process of trying to put together a better web-based and also in-paper guidance document to help landowners identify those resources and work with tribes. In the process of developing this, we found that in the early drafts of this, there were some elements that are mandatory in statute, particularly those relating to archaeological resources, and some that are more voluntary related to cultural resources plans between tribes and landowners. And so we were working to separate those two issues and really clarify how that process works. In the middle of this discussion, we had a situation come up where one of the members of the roundtable, one of the tribal members, brought to the roundtable an issue of controversy related to concerns about the way that DNR was interpreting the WAC on conditioning forest practices applications for cultural resources reasons. And I'm just going to give you a brief history of what I found out and what the roundtable looked at, and then perhaps some steps forward that we need to go. You are
we're at the point where we're giving you the annual report, and we're kind of in the beginning of this controversy, so you'll get to see public policy made up close and personal. So in the late 90s, Department of Natural Resources, I guess particularly in the Southeast region, utilize what are called blanket conditions for FPAs related to cultural resources plans. So a condition of the forest practices application was essentially compliance with a cultural resources plan that had been developed between the tribe and the landowner. Those plans were generally not attached to the forest practices application, but the application itself was conditioned on the plan. And the thought was that the landowner and the tribe had agreed to that, and so that could be part of that application. That practice, as far as we can tell, was not necessarily widespread throughout the state. So the Southeast region definitely did the blanket conditioning. Other parts of the state, DNR regions, may have done other types of conditioning, some blank and some not. But the cultural resources, what we found to date, is that mainly it was focused in that area. In the early aughts, early to mid aughts, there was a series of forest practices appeals cases that dealt with the conditioning authority of Department of Natural Resources. And it was not specific, as far as I can tell, to cultural resources, but wildlife plans and some other elements, where the board pretty clearly laid out what DNR's authority was in terms of being able to put different types of conditions in forest practices applications. And I think there was some discussion within DNR about how they would implement that. And over time, DNR regions, both Southeast region and the rest of the state, moved away from blanket conditions and moved more towards being very specific about how they would condition FPAs. And I know this is a lot of history, but it's important in terms of understanding where the controversy is. And so I don't believe that there was a lot of communication between the roundtable and Department of Natural Resources about this situation and how the conditioning practice had changed over time. Last year, one of our tribal members from the roundtable asked DNR Southeast Region to put a blanket condition on an FPA, and DNR refused because of the practice that they had in terms of conditioning over time and their understanding of what their legal authorities were. So that has created quite a bit of consternation within the roundtable in terms of understanding how the communication happens between the roundtable and the Department of Natural Resources and implementing that process, as well as what the authority is and the basis of the authority for conditioning. Forest Practices Board has adopted a WAC that talks specifically about the fact that DNR may condition the forest practices application on the plan. And some members of the roundtable view that as being appropriate for DNR to utilize a blanket condition, and others do not. DNR at this point in time, I believe, is taking recommendations from tribal members or others in this process that may be in the plan, but specific conditions that they actually feel they have authority to, and putting those in as conditions. So there's just a level of understanding about conditioning authority that we don't yet have at the roundtable. So this is the point that we're at this point in time. My suggestion, as well as others at the roundtable, would be that we would move forward in the process of more understanding about the FPA authority, and then look to see if that creates problems in the very interesting and actually pretty collegial program that we have of landowners and tribes understanding cultural resources and protecting them through the forest practices process. I also want to say that this has, as I said, create a consternation within the roundtable. I cannot underestimate the amount of concern that we have from some of our tribal members at the roundtable. And so this is a pretty sensitive situation, because you're talking about how we protect, how we legally protect and enforce those protections on cultural resources, and try to put together a program that works for everybody. So I'll stop there. If you have questions.
thanks. Just to be clear, the plans that we're talking about that had been part of maybe a blanket condition in the past, these plans and the current plans that are under discussion here, these are plans that landowners have agreed to. So the only question is whether they become part of the permit and enforceable there under or not.
There are actually a number of questions related to that. So these are plans that landowners and tribes agreed to. DNR is not part of that process. This is a negotiation between those two entities. And the question is whether or not putting a blanket condition in an FPA for a plan that nobody has seen or is not attached to the FPA is an appropriate authority that DNR has or should have.
Yeah, the key thing I just keep in my head is that we already have an agreement between two important parties.
Right.
And so the question is, how do you make sure that it's implemented?
Right.
So I understand the distinction.
And one follow-up on that. And part of the issue related to conditioning on an entire plan is that because those plans are agreed to between the landowner and the tribe, DNR may not have the regulatory authority to enforce every single one of those pieces of the plan. And so that, I think, drives, and that's, I think, what the Horse Practices Appeals Board found in terms of some other plans. It drives what is actually in the Horse Practices Act. Because if you put a condition in the Horse Practices Act that the Department of Natural Resources can't enforce, it's meaningless at best.
So then the plan going forward is for the roundtable to sit down with the DNR staff people to try to find a resolution then? Is that what you're proposing?
I am, and we have sat down. We've had two meetings with DNR division folks, and they've been pretty good meetings, but I think we need to have additional discussions with them and potentially some of the AAGs that could give us, you know, clarity in terms of what the conditioning authority is. And then I think we need to back up and look at how that works in the process. Because these plans for a large number of them are plans between large landowners and tribes. I don't think there are as many between medium and small sized landowners as and tribes as others. But once a horse practices application comes into the system, if it includes elements that are protection that are already incorporated into the plan, that comes in as essentially the landowner's offer to get an application, a harvest application done. And so some of the question becomes for a small landowner that might not have understood that they need to have a plan or have a conversation with the tribe prior to the time that the application is actually submitted. How does the process work from that point on when the plan comes together or the agreement comes together after the application has actually been submitted? And I think that's probably the area where there's the most opportunity for discussion about some creative solutions. The instructions that I talked about for the Horse Practices Act were in part really designed to help landowners that hadn't dealt with tribes very much on cultural resources understand that there is a process in place. You have to go through the process, you have to talk to people, you have to protect cultural resources. But we may need to figure out more information and instructions, more information in terms of outreach to folks. I'm just not certain what the process would be at this point, but I think that's the kind of resolution we'll probably be looking for.
So do you have a sense of what's the timeline here for trying to get this resolved?
I would hope that we could begin to at least have the understanding process happen a little bit better in this next 2 or 3 months. I would hope that our resolution can happen in a fairly short period of time. But again, there's a lot of emotion surrounding this. And I think that in addition to the specifics of the FPA and the conditioning authority for cultural resources, we also need to have a really clear understanding of the communication between the roundtable and DNR. I think that this change happened over time and it evolved. And so it wasn't, I don't think there was evil intent on anybody's part here. It was just the fact that things move in different directions at different timelines. And we just need to figure out as a sort of a liaison between the forest practices system, landowners, and tribes, how the roundtable can fill that role better.
Board Member Stanley?
I'm confused on how it works, Karen, a bit. A lot of the sites, the cultural sites, the landowners and tribes have worked out, doesn't want to get into the public process.
Right.
And is that one of the, it seems like it's a really hard thing to have an FPA conditioned on sites that folks don't want people to know about.
Right, absolutely, and I think the reason that folks don't want people to know about is that these are sensitive sites, and so maintaining the confidentiality of those sites is really important. One option might be that the plans would be attached to the Forest Practices Act. One the concern that's been brought up, and both by tribal folks and landowners at the roundtable, is that if you do that, there is a process for redacting information for sensitive sites and trying to keep that information confidential. But we want to make sure that the process works in every instance, and we're concerned that it might not. You also have the issue of DNR may not have the authority to enforce each of those conditions in the plan. And so what landowners that have active plans, active agreements with tribes, I think generally do, is when they put their Forest Practices app in and they have, say they're trying to maintain certain type of site, when they put their Forest Practices application in and they have a map, they bound those sites out. They don't put a big star on the site to say this is a cultural resource, but they bound it out so that it's protected in the process. So especially with industrial landowners, that I think that's common practice. And there's a long history in most areas of strong communication between larger landowners and tribes. Problem comes about when you've got an individual, say a small forest landowner, that may only harvest once every 40 years or less, and doesn't have the background in terms of understanding what the regulations say, what the rules say, and moving forward in the process. Puts in a forest practices application, gets a review from the Department of Archaeological Historical Programs, or from a tribal member that's doing the FPA reviews, and a tribal member or a tribal reviewer says, we have a cultural site there. Goes and talks to the landowner, develops a plan, but that application is already in. So what happens with that application, and how does DNR work to respond to the needs of the landowner and also the needs of the tribe in terms of protecting those cultural resources? My sense is if you've got agreement between the tribe and the landowner, the protection is going to happen. But I think that there is some concern that those plans need to be enforceable, or at least the conditions that are most important need to be enforceable. And so that's, I think, the crux of this discussion.
Other questions? Karen? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we will break for lunch here. We'll be back a bit later than what's on the agenda, since